Welcome. This is Efrat Sabalevsky from YU Connects, happy to introduce Candidate, a candid conversation about today's dating life with experienced guests. Our wonderful host this evening is Rabbi Shmuel Ismach, Rabbi of Young Israel of Great Neck and Rebbe in the Stone-based Medrash program at Yeshiva University. This podcast is anonymously sponsored Le'iloi Nishmas Chanoch Chaim Ben Yaakov HaKohen.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Candidate, a candid conversation about dating and relationships with experts in the field. My name is Shmuel Ismach. I'm the rabbi at the Young Israel of Great Neck and a rebbe at the BMP program at Yeshiva University. With me today, I am very excited to have Dr. David Pelkovitz. He really needs no introduction. His formal title is he holds the Strauss Chair of Psychology and Education at Azrieli Graduate School, professor at YU, Azrieli, and Reitz, and somebody who I think is a familiar face and a familiar voice, particularly in the area of mental health in the Jewish community. What we're here to talk about today is the discussion about parents and their relationship with their dating children. Try to figure out and pin down what exactly are the appropriate roles, what's considered to be too much. So I guess to begin, Dr. Pelkovitz, first of all, welcome. How are you?
Thank God. It's a pleasure to be here, an honor to be here.
Yes, yes. The pleasure was really all mine. So let's start with my first question. We tend to have, in the variety of communities which feed our listeners, our listeners really come from different communities, not just the YU community, but, in all directions, different roles that parents might take in the dating process, forgetting about just when decisions are being made, but even in trying to filter out who the children are going to be dating. Could you speak to those differences and what you think is the most beneficial? And if one particular, let's say, community you think has a problem, how do we figure out a way to overcome that problem? How do you see this divide?
Yeah, so it's a complicated challenge. Because in the community that we're focusing on, in the modern Orthodox community, there's a there's an interesting kind of mix. There's many of the guys come back from their years of studying in Israel with a very different kind of mindset, where they feel that the real experts on who they should marry or the kind of men or women that they should go out with. That's something that Rosh Yeshiva, especially their Israeli mentors, are the ones to go to, and or their friends. So I know that Dr. Levitz, who was my predecessor when he was at YU and is now in Israel, who was a real expert in this area, he said that the system in our community is unique in that there's so much emphasis put on the role of friends and the role of Israeli rabbis, de-emphasizing the role of parents who unfortunately know us best. Like, who knows us better than parents? And I think deep down, if you wake your son or daughter up who's, going out in the middle of the night and you ask them, who would you really go to if you were in big trouble? Who is it who really knows you in the deepest kind of way? They acknowledge that it's their parents. But it takes a delicate touch that's a combination of listening and respecting their point of view, hearing what they're saying about their friends think is best for them, what their teachers who they look up to in terms of religious mentors think of them. But the bottom line is that we need to do a better job of reminding them that the role of the parents is very much one where they are all important, but it's a code book. It's sort of like there's a confusion about what's the rule book, and it's a complicated rule book in terms of a lot of misconceptions about what matters and what doesn't matter when it comes to figuring out who you're going to spend the rest of your life with.
So let me interrupt you. The question I have is, so when you talk about the parental involvement and the benefit of it, you know, you really know the child, and as you said, the child ultimately is the most dependent on the parent figure more so than their friends or the rebbeim. But there seem to me to be two stages when we talk about dating. There's the vetting, who should I be dating? And then there's the how the relationship is going. Is it going well? Is this working? Is this what I need now that I'm really presented with all the facts? Is there a distinction to be made? Is the reason that maybe children are looking for those other people to be involved, not parents so much, is because maybe they think they want something differently categorically than what the parents want? And then maybe it would be great if the parents step in after once the relationship exists. You know, is this going well? Are you reacting appropriately? Or do you think that parents, you know, do parents cause more friction between the child in trying to pick who the match, the mate, the potential mate should be? I just see this as like two stages. Is it better if the parents are doing the vetting also? Or does that create the identity crisis that sometimes children and parents deal with? And like, who am I and what am I looking for? Can parents help with that?
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking. In terms of the vetting, obviously, in the more right-wing segment of the community, very often it's pretty much the parents, often the mothers, you know, depending on the family, who do all the vetting. And sometimes that has its own problems, because it could be that, you know, they don't really understand what's a good predictor. Sometimes the emphasis is in all the wrong areas. Right. So I think that's in the modern Orthodox community very often.
Hang up. The mother has a hang up that, you know, gets a no every time. And the kid, of course, would be much more open-minded to something and more reasonable. Yeah, I hear that.
So I think it is at that level. We have to be very careful. But then there's the other level, what happens as it deepens. And there, I think parents have an awful lot to offer. Again, nobody knows their kids better than a mother and a father, especially if they have a good relationship. And I find that very often what happens is there's like a really a misplaced emphasis on things that are not predictive at all. In other words, you know, I'm reminded of somebody who was going out with somebody who, anybody who really knew this young man, knew that this woman was, that they were just good together, you know, in terms of all the predictors that you look at. You know, they had similar interests, they had similar temperaments, each brought out the best in the other, everything was good. But once he was frustrated in looking for a parking spot in Manhattan, which is certainly not an easy thing to find. And he said something, and I'm not making this up. He said, "Darn it, I can't, gosh, darn it." And she called whoever set them up and said, "I have to break it off because he curses." And the word was the word that I don't think anybody in their right mind would consider to be a curse word. So sometimes there's just misplaced expectations and not understanding what are the real predictors of success in a marriage? What are the things that really matter? And there's often a lot of misconceptions about that. So that's something that it's something that I think we have to do a better job of teaching them. You know, what does the psychology literature tell us about what really matters? What is it that's associated with really success, and what is totally irrelevant? And we know some stuff about that. It's not quite a science, but we do know about it.
Right. So the question then becomes: so who should be that first responder? And I guess the gatekeeper. Is it best if it's the child, or is it perhaps better if it's the parent? I guess on the one hand, the parent might have their own superficial things that they're bringing into this that are real irrelevant. But at the same time, the parent does know the child very well. I guess the counterpoint is the kid managing all of it. And, you know, they're not kids. We're talking about adults over here. I was just speaking to somebody who honestly, he's a kid, a young adult male who's busy dating. And he'll probably be listening to this, and this is not a criticism, but, you know, he was describing how Shadchanim sent him the pictures and they sent him the resumes, and he's literally like swiping through his phone, going through the you know, this is the experience. The experience is now, so he has a phone full of resumes and pictures, and he's going for this versus that. And I'm not sure if like the kids themselves, the young adults, have the maturity to be able to administer this entire process. You know, it could be that having an adult involved who's a little bit detached and isn't going to react as maybe emotionally or with a level of attraction. Wow, that's a great picture. I'm into that. Me personally, I'm into that. You know, a person who has that distance, the parent who has that distance, maybe that is a productive thing. So I don't know. What would you say in the final, if we had to, Paskin? What is the best model for the vetting? We'll get to the stage two in a second. But what would you recommend for kids as the?
I think that friends who really know, like really good close friends, probably do know an awful lot about who the right person would be. They have a, you know, unique understanding, and then you know what you just raised about goes to the other area of the paradox of choice. The more choice you have, the less satisfied you tend to be with the choice that you make. You know, Dr. Schwartz's book on that. What is it when the number of flavors of Listerine were cut from something, I don't know, like 30, 40 flavors, however many it was, down to just I think 6 or 7 choices, sales tripled. And the same thing with buying cars, you know.
Yeah, Malcolm Gladwell has an old shtickle about this, you know, with
right, you know, yeah.
And the supermarket and the 24 choices versus the four sold more than the 24, the paralysis by analysis, our inability to choose.
Yeah. And it's very real, and it's very operative, especially for men. You know, men, you know, there's a shortage of men relative to women. There's some highly, highly qualified women. If I could just share with you, before COVID, I was scholar in residence on the West Side. Our host, who I think at the time was the rabbi of the, you know, the rabbi of the shul that invited me to be scholar in residence, they had, I think, five couples, you know, consisting of 5 men and 5 women sitting on the table opposite from each other. They had never met, with the idea being that maybe, you know, this would be a good way to, you know, to have people meet each other. And these are people who were on the older end of things and hadn't managed to find the right person on the West Side, where there's a way paralyzing a man of choice. And one of the things that I think is operative here is the women introduced themselves to me and to my wife, Delani. You know, it was so impressive. You know, one was, you know, a surgeon, the other was a partner in one of the top accounting firms, and it went on, each one more impressive than the next. And the men were in a whole other stage of life. They were finding themselves. They were figuring out what they were going to be doing. And that's another reality that's coming up, is that there's these demographic shifts, and that could be problematic.
Wow. Okay. So, and that, not to add any more pressure, but so let me just, so get back to the parent question. If you have, there are reasons, I guess, going both ways, depending on circumstances, for parents to be involved or not be as involved when it comes to the vetting of the shidduch in the first place. But let's move on to the relationship. So you have two people dating. And I actually asked this to one of my students recently. I said, so, you know, when you have stuff going on, who are you talking to? Like, who are you checking with? Are you checking with your parents when you have questions? Are you checking with the shanchan? Are you checking with friends for their experiences? Are you checking with a rebbe? What do you think is the best role of parents? I mean, this is one version of the question, the best role as the dater should take it. I want to ask a separate question later, which we'll talk about the role of the parents, right? What the parent, to what extent they should meddle. But what do you think, where do you think they'll get their best advice, the dater, with all of those?
Again, I have a bias to think parents, if they have a reasonably positive relationship, I think that, you know, parents have the deepest understanding of what the needs are of a child. That doesn't mean that there isn't, you know, sort of a convergence of very valuable information from other sources.
Right. They might not be experts in relationships. They might be experts in the child. But if something happens on the relationship, you know, you might have somebody who is more experienced and have might be able to provide more.
Absolutely. And one more thing, which I'll just throw into the mix because it becomes very relevant, is, you know, remember the Romeo and Juliet effect and the shaky bridge study. So the, you know, if somebody really, let's say the man or the woman really thinks that somebody is right for them, and some of their friends are even supporting them a little bit. And they and the parents is very upset because they know their kid and they feel this is not a good match for you. This person is too critical, or he's too demanding, or comes from a family of just totally different values. That could be, you know, sometimes it's just something that we should keep in mind in talking about this issue of the role of the parents is the shaky bridge study was they took people in like the Cornell University in Ithaca area and took them and had them walk over a shaky bridge. And in the middle of the bridge, they met an attractive research assistant who interviewed them. Okay. And then at the other end of the bridge, they had them rate this interviewer on how attractive was she on a scale of 1 to 10. And it turned out that if you were on a steady bridge, you gave a rating of attractiveness that was significantly lower than you would give if it was a shaky bridge. Because if you're nervous and you're anxious and you're sort of like, you know, going through a tough time in your life, you may connect very strongly to somebody who you may not see the same way down the road. You know, because the reality is our attraction to people very much shifts over time. We change over time. Our religious preferences change. Our attraction to people change. And then, of course, there's the Romeo and Juliet effect where parents in particular have to be very careful about how they handle disagreement over the choice that their child has for who they want to spend the rest of their lives with.
Okay, so I'm processing all this. The shaky bridge, I'm never going to sing Kol HaOlam Kulo Gesher Tzar Meod the same way ever again. That's first of all. But we have, so meaning people who are in one sort of situation, life situation, might react one way to a person, whereas if they are in a more calm and stable situation differently. I mean, that causes also, we should do a whole podcast just on that, because how do you check yourself to make sure where you are in life when you are dating, to make sure you're on the stable bridge, the narrow bridge, or whatever it is. So that's fascinating. But we're also dealing with the Romeo and Juliet phenomenon, where you might be attracted to somebody specifically because your parents.
Right.
Could you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, it's very real, you know, that if let's say somebody falls in love with a woman who's of a different faith or comes from a much more modern background or a much more right-wing background, you know, both could be really problematic. And it becomes the focus of tremendous tension and yelling and screaming. You may end up with that person, even though it's not the right person for you, because you find solace in each other's arms. So that's you know, that Romeo and Juliet thing. That's exactly, we all know how that turned out.
Is it the solace? Is it the?
Yeah, I think it's the solace. You know, where else are you going to find a sense of comfort and acceptance other than one another's arms?
Also have something to do with the relationship between the child and the parents in the first place, meaning should a parent aware, or at least attempt to be aware and understand? I know you've done research with this when it comes to religious growth and the flip out phenomenon, and that how much of that is tied to parental and child involvement and relationship to begin with. So it could be that parents really should do an analysis of their relationship before they choose to interfere or to get involved actively in this process that might be helpful for them and for the kids as well. Which leads me to my next question, which is, your child's dating somebody, and for whatever reason, either the parent vetted and didn't do a complete job, or information was revealed later, or the child vetted, whatever it was, and the parent discovers something that they're very unhappy with. Maybe it's a conversation that's recounted and you don't like how the response went, or maybe something more fundamental in the biography of the candidate that your child's dating. What should the parent do? You know, to avoid the Romeo and Juliet, to avoid the idea of meddling and to not take away their autonomy. Well, what's the best practice there?
Yeah, I, again, the key, a few basic guidelines. The first thing is low expressed emotion. You know, the research on parent-child communication, including adult children, is the higher the level of emotionality, the higher the level of yelling and screaming and criticism characterizes the discussion, the more your kid is going to develop parent deafness. So what you want to do is you want to make sure that when you sit down and talk about it, that it comes from a calm place where you spend a lot of time trying to the whole idea of to be understood first, understand. You're going to want to share how you feel, but you want to come up with the time where you sit down, you come up with a time that's not rushed, you know, where you shut off your phones and you go to a place where hopefully you can have a nice kind of conversation, you know, that is not going to be derailed, you know, by emotionality. And that's hard. You know, there's nothing as precious to us as the happiness of our children, and no more important decision that you're going to make in your life than figuring out who you're going to marry. So there's such high stakes that parents could come across as way too judgy. So I think that's, you know, so a lot of it has to do with striking when the iron is cold and having that kind of conversation. Remember, you know, as I often say, to the point of nausea, the word ozen, right, the instrument of listening, is etymologically tied to the word maznayim. There's something very balancing about listening to people and hearing them out in a way that you really try to understand it. And then you can be very clear about what your concerns are.
It's the type of communication that you do. And that would be the best way to communicate your frustration.
Type, timing, and mindset. And obviously, you know, and even then there's not going to be a great guarantee because it has a lot to do with what your relationship was like beforehand.
Right. So let's take it one step further. Let's imagine a parent sees the inevitability of a relationship. It's going to happen. There's no question it's going to happen. What are some great methods for, if there are any, to assist the parent in swallowing and moving on? It is what it is. My son, my daughter is happy. And listen, this wouldn't have been my first choice. Like, how do we do that? What's the best practice in really just wrapping our head around reality?
Yeah, and that was once they're married, or maybe
it's inevitable. It's gonna happen, and I gotta wrap my head around it. It's tough to know, of course, in every relationship exactly what point that is, and maybe I could say one more thing, and that'll influence them. And you know, unfortunately, towards the end of that is when you have the most heated conversations, when we're almost too late to stop this. But it's inevitable, and you've realized it's gonna happen. What's a good method for a parent to be able to overcome and now live a beautiful life with their new son or daughter-in-law?
Yeah. So again, to be very concrete, it's to keep them close. It's basically to figure out a way to spend. There might have to be a forgiveness discussion where you may want to sit down and a planned discussion with them and just apologize for anything you may have said that might have really, turned them off, or might have been said in anger, and just to make very clear that you want to make amends, and you come up with, the right kind of strategies for how to spend the Shabbos together, how to spend. I would not spend a 3-day yuntif together. Okay. But I would spend possibly, you know, like this time of year where you have Shabbos is over much earlier than it had been. That would be a perfect kind of Shabbos to spend with the prearranged, as you keep it short and sweet. And I'm amazed that over time, I've been doing this for 40 years or way too long. I'm amazed at how often incredibly, incredibly tense mother-in-law, father-in-law, you know, son-in-law, or daughter-in-law kind of relationships where I thought they would never, ever reconcile and never have a relationship. But over time, it often, things could really, really work out. And doing this for a long time gives me a certain amount of humility because I had absolutely no belief that this is going to work out over time. And then it often does in ways that are pretty amazing.
Let's say the parent wants to avoid the conflagration in the first place, and they want to tell themselves, like, listen, I don't want to start a fight. I need a method. You know, they call you up, Dr. Palkovitz. I need help. This is really bothering me about this relationship. I realize it's not something to make a federal case over, but I need a tactic. I need a skill to help me get over this. It's going to bother me. I know if I bring it up, it's not going to be constructive. How do I get over the fact that he is, I don't know, his name is this, or I have a hang up, whatever it is, positive, you know, in any direction. What's a great tactic? I mean, it could be the answer just is the same thing, you know, you get what you get and you don't get upset, like something as profound as that bumper sticker. But what would you tell a person who called you with that question?
I mean, once you know for sure that this is it.
We're not fighting about it. I'm just unhappy. Like, I want to look at this son or daughter-in-law in the best possible light, but I have trouble doing so. I got to hang up. Like, I'm not marrying the person, but I want to be able to respect. Like, what would you tell such a person? Because this is not, you know, a business partner. This is your child. This is going to be the father of your grandchildren or the mother of your grandchildren. This is somebody who you're really living an intimate existence with. Is there like a best way to tell yourself or to explain to yourself why it's okay and push yourself over that hump?
You know, to get concrete about it, number one is to recognize that once your son or daughter gets married, that the job of your child is to show their loyalty, number one, loyalty to their spouse. Okay, now so vicious of a vicimo, okay? You know, this is this is part of healthy individuation. And so number one is to support that and is to have a spot in your head that recognizes it. On the other hand, some simple psychoeducation about how families differ. So families really differ along two core dimensions. And I hope I'm not getting too shrinky here, but families and all the factor analytic studies on families, it's on the dimension of enmeshed versus disengaged. So enmeshed is, you know, where you're way too close and, you know, put on a sweater, I'm cold. Okay. And on the other end is disengaged, you know, where maybe you'll give your kid a hug once a year when you give them a bracha just before Yom Kippur, but otherwise you will never touch your child. You'll never hug your child. And there are those two dimensions. And then the other major dimension is rigid versus chaotic. So rigid is where, you know, there's a rule that Yehoreg Val Yavar, no matter what, that you call me every Friday before Shabbos. On my birthday, you make sure that you get me the right kind of presents. And if we're getting together for an 8 p.m. dinner at the local restaurant, you better be there at 8 p.m. If you're there at 8:01, it's no good. And if you're there at 7:59, it's no good. Versus chaotic, where, you know, you're just not sure. And sometimes understanding that and understanding this is what people do for a living. This is that, you know, people, these things don't easily change. Issues like money, issues like those two dimensions don't change. And doing a lot of work where you learn that this is okay. I had a professor who would say, there are two kinds of people. they're normal people, and they're people I know. Hmm. Once you get to know the family that your child married into, you're going to think that they're all crazy. And your son may think like, well, I can't believe it. They're nuts. But with time, I wrote an article about this book that goes into details about this. I'm happy to share it. And my thinking about this was very much molded by Dr. Ronan Novick, the dean of Azrieli, who really has very clear thinking about this. And culture comes in. What happens if it's an Ashkenaz Sephardic marriage? There are all kinds of things like that. And the key is to figure out how to recognize that there's going to be conflicting perceptions, but you absolutely have to know where your loyalty lies. And that's hard. It's hard.
So first of all, that was the perfect amount of shrinky. I just want to let you know, that was the exact, precise, beautiful level of shrink. Okay. So you mentioned this loyalty, and I want to talk about this. This should be our last, to close the conversation. Is that true in 100% of the time? Let's establish axioms that when you have a married couple, the number one loyalty, the number one direction of devotion is towards the spouse. Is that true? Is there ever an exception? Obviously in extreme scenarios, but is it always facing each other first and sensitivity to spouse first, and to the extent that the parents should be able to understand that?
Yeah, I think so. And it's painful. It hurts. And there's a lot that the couple could do. You could call your father-in-law every Friday afternoon just to say, hi, I'm just checking in, something that'll take you 1 minute and might go a long way. You should, make sure that there are all kinds of ways that are not that time intensive or emotionally exhausting that can make a huge difference. But in general, I remember the feeling when my kids got married and they didn't come home with me after the wedding. That's tough. That's tough. It's the loss. What is it? What they say? It's that's why the word sason is used in the Shevet Brachos, because sason, according to the sason, is the Hebrew word for happiness tinged with sadness. According to the Vilna Gaon, it's happiness tinged with sadness, and that's the feeling. That's the feeling here.
Wow. So might be beneficial. I don't know if enough parents do this, but having a sit down with your daughter or your son and saying that we love you very much, and we just want to let you know that when it comes to your shalom bias, your spouse is first, even before us. Might that be a valuable conversation? We're supposed to have the talk when they're young about certain topics. So maybe there is a talk, the ultimate shalom bias talk that should come from parents, where they forfeit their rights to be the first and foremost in your mind, and they somehow transmit it. When they do that handoff on the way to the chuppah, they mean it. Should that be something that is part of our...
I think it would go a long way. And it's one of those paradoxes in life that the more space you give the couple to find their own voice and to go on to the next stage in a way that, you're never going to get anywhere by being critical of a new son-in-law or a new daughter-in-law. I think about my own in-laws. They never in the 40 plus years of my marriage, they never once, neither of them ever said a single critical thing to me. That's the way I've balanced my, in terms of my own children.
You are a super guy. I couldn't imagine anything to say either. But yeah, that's a good mussar. That's a good mussar. Yeah. It's just not helpful. It's just not the place where that type of stuff has to come from. Is it valuable ever for them to criticize you through your wife? Meaning for them, for the parents to sort of, I think you should let your husband know. We've transcended from parents and dating to parents and marriage. And it's probably the subject for another podcast, which, let's leave that question in the air. We're going to have another conversation while you candidate become marriage. And then we'll talk about that then. But Okay, this has been really, really great. Thank you so much, Dr. Pelkovitz, for your guidance, your advice in this realm. And any questions that parents might have, remember, your role is critical. It's really important. And let's not make any Romeo and Juliets. So if there's nothing else, Dr. Pelkovitz, to close, I want to thank you on behalf of our audience for the time you've provided for us today. And thank you for your guidance.
My pleasure. Beware of shaky bridges.
Beware of shaky bridges and Shakespearean sonnets. Okay, excellent. Thank you so much. And thank you to our audience for tuning in. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you to our gracious host and guests this evening. Please email us at yuconnects@yu.edu to suggest future dating and relationship building topics and guests for your enjoyment. Candidate at YU Connects.